morning, everybody. It's Victor Adair, and I'm sitting in for Michael Campbell, who remains on a very well-deserved vacation in Europe. And Michael plans to be back here next week. I'm certainly planning on having him back here next week. But it is fun for me to come and host the show, get to pick some special guests and have our regulars here as well. Michael Levy is going to be here. He's going to talk about a very important segment of the stock market. Ozzie Jurek is going to be here talking about pre-sales and why people do that and the things you got to watch out for in the real estate market. Our special guest today, one of the speakers at the World Outlook Conference this year, Kevin Muir. And Kevin is somebody I very much admired. I've read all of his weekly reports going back for 5 years or so. A couple of years ago, he went behind a paywall on Substack. I became a subscriber. I stay in touch with Kevin. Very happy to attend the speaker's dinner with him after the World Outlook Conference and learn some more about Kevin. But anyway, let's get into the show. And we've got Michael Levy on deck. As I say, he's going to talk about an aspect of the stock market. Certainly the headlines on the stock market have been captured by mega cap tech and what is happening there and how there's like two parts to the stock market. There's mega cap tech and then there's everything else. And it's like everything else doesn't matter almost. But Michael, this week, the major Canadian banks came out with their quarterly reports for the first quarter of this year. And, what did you make of those reports?
Well, there's a couple things, and the two things, and I'll go over them very briefly, each one of them, Victor, but the two things that stand out is, number one, every one of the banks except CIBC came in well below analyst estimates of what they were going to do in the quarter. And all of the banks, save TD, who plan on doing what the other banks did, raise their dividends even with the weak quarterly results. So they are certainly not what they were last quarter or the quarters in the latter part of 2022. But let's just whip through them quickly. TD canceled their U.S. $13.5 billion takeover of Tennessee-based First Horizon. And they plan to use the allotted cash to buy back shares. So basically, they're going to benefit the shareholders. They're going to purchase about 30 million shares. That's about 1.6% of the outstanding. And they are going to raise their dividend. RBC profit fell 14% from a year earlier. And as did four of the five banks reporting, they raised their quarterly shareholder dividend. It's only by 3 cents a share to $1.35 per quarter, but they just followed in line. CIBC, that was the only outlier, surprised everybody, Victor, of the five majors reporting second quarter earnings. They beat all estimates, and they were well above analyst estimates, earning about $1.69 billion. Victor, they raised their quarterly dividend to 87 cents a share from 85. BMO, I could just say carbon copy, well under analyst estimates, earned about $1.06 billion in the quarter. They earned $4.76 billion in the same quarter last year. They raised their quarterly dividend 4 cents to $1.47 a share. Scotiabank, net income fell 21%. Need I go on? Well under analyst estimates, and they also marginally raised their dividends. So it was a disappointing quarter, except for CIBC. And the outlook of the banks themselves is they may be looking at further disappointments down the road, but it's not that bright and cheery that we heard the end of last quarter.
Well, of course, banks around the world have not had a great year. We've had the banking crisis, as I've called it, in the United States. When I look at the share prices of the Canadian banks, and given that you sent me the notes a couple of days ago, I had some chance to do some homework, and it's not surprising because the banks are such a big part of the Toronto Stock Exchange. But most of the banks had their all-time highs in the first quarter of last year and came down since then. I think Royal Bank, for instance, was around $150 a share at their all-time highs in quarter one of last year, and they're about $120 now. So we've got a decline of that magnitude. And it's interesting that the chart patterns of the banks, you know, if you look at the big picture, looks very much like the chart pattern of the Toronto Stock Exchange index, because the big banks are so important to the overall index.
Well, they are, Victor, and I think that the warnings that they've given, I think we have to take seriously, particularly, and this was the highlight, and I don't mean a highlight, it's a low light for me, but this is something that really stuck out, and that's loan loss provisions. The loans they have on their books that they think may or could go bad, and they have to take provisions for those loans. That comes right out of the profit sector, so that's why you see so more, or profit side, that's why you see the banks faltering on the profit end, is these big provisions they have to take. But listen to these numbers. TD have taken just about $600 million in loan loss provisions, BMO $1.02 billion, Scotia $709 million, CIBC $303 million, the lowest, and they're the ones that made up, you know, more money or made money this this last quarter, and RBC $600 million. Now, that's not to say they're going to lose that kind of money, but that, under the rules, are the provisions they have to take to tuck away in case of bad loans. And they are anticipating that there are going to be some bad loans.
You know, the way I look at that is, I think that's being is doing the right thing. You know, as Mike and I have talked so many times on the show here the past few months, there will be consequences to having raised interest rates so much so quickly after having a decade plus of interest rates roughly at zero. And when, you know, we've had this big increase, there's some people who had a business model that worked, some businesses, I should say, that had a business model that worked really well with 0% interest rates. But now that interest rates are substantially above that, yeah, I think the banks are being prudent. It wouldn't shock me, that's for sure. And it's given also, you know, what we've seen in the United States where, you know, the world of banking is changing. So, yeah, I'm happy to see, honestly, that they've like fessed up, you know, and are telling the truth, that they're a little worried that things are going to change.
Well, Victor, I think you've nailed it right there. Interest rates, pardon me, are going to have to come down materially for this scenario to change. They can't stay up where they are now and have the same kind of results that they were having previously. It's lower interest rates, which will take the burden off a lot of the people who are borrowing money as rates come down. But also it's going to help mortgages, because that's a big part of where the banks make their money. It's going to, people who have lines of credit, it's impacting them. So if we were to see the central bank succeed in what they're trying to do in bringing down interest rates, even by just somewhat, I mean, not all the way back down to 2% or even 3%, but to bring those interest rates back down would make a material difference as far as I'm concerned. But Victor, Morningstar, and I think we both know who they are, they're a well-known investment research firm, calls the Canadian bank's earnings as a shot across the bow. Well, that from Morningside, who are well-respected in their analysis, that sends a bit of a shiver down my spine.
Well, I think, you know, again, one of the consequences of having raised interest rates as much as the central banks have in the last year is shifting some behavior on the side of the consumers from, let's say this, if interest rates are essentially zero, people who would be savers have to look to do something else with their money. Now, when interest rates are at 5% or whatever, and you can get on GICs, people that might have been, call it, speculating in the stock market or the commodity market or whatever, can more comfortably move back into, you know, buying government bonds, buying GICs, In other words, people who should have been savers can go back to being savers, and that will happen. I guess I'm saying that because I think if people are going, Canadians, you know, of a certain age like us, if you were going to go invest in the stock market, you might be more likely to buy shares in a Canadian bank than into some speculative, issue on the venture exchange. So I think it's very important that we know what's going on with the banks.
And that's very interesting because I was talking earlier today to my son, Robert, and we, of course, talk as you and I or Mike and I and you do. We talk about the markets, about investment, and he was saying that, you know what, maybe the banks have to start to look to raise their dividends, even in this kind of an atmosphere, in order to attract investors to buy a bank that has a dividend not of 3 or 4%, but maybe they've got to get these dividends back up to 5 or 6%. And that's an interesting scenario because otherwise, how do they attract investors back in unless they're doing exceedingly well? And that might be part of a method in their madness, I'd say madness in quotes, of raising the dividends even with poorer results than anybody anticipated.
Well, we've certainly seen in the United States, people have been net sellers of shares in banks, and there's been a massive flow of money into money market funds. Just looking for safety when the interest you earned on a checking deposit or even a savings deposit in the American banks was pretty tiny. Certainly, Mike, money moves around, and the Canadian banks here are relative to banks in other parts of the world, I see in the notes you sent me, are doing pretty good.
Oh, they are. And again, and I've said this for many years with Mike, if I'm going to be in the market, there's no place on a steady basis without the kind of risk that maybe you would have if you were investing in high tech, which has had the kind of growth you were talking about at the outset. But I think that we are going to have to see things steady out a little bit, and I think that we just have to see a better feeling out there. The feeling out there now is not good. Like when you talk to people, they just don't feel that good about most anything, and that's a scenario that's going to have to change.
Well, as Mike Campbell would say, we will be here to chronicle it. Mike, thanks for taking the time to visit with us this morning.
Victor, the last 3 weeks have been a pleasure.
Thank you. Well, welcome back. I'm very happy to tell you we've got Kevin Muir on the line with us here. Kevin was one of the key speakers at the World Outlook Conference that we had this year at the Bayshore Hotel. I've been reading Kevin's weekly letters for, well, I guess it's at least 5 years. And then a couple of years ago, he went behind a paywall on Substack and I became a subscriber. I really like the things that he has to say about markets. You know, last week we were talking with Greg Weldon. And one of the points I made about Greg was that he was not only an analyst, but he was also a trader. And Kevin's the same. You know, he maybe he's first and foremost, he's a trader, and then he writes his thoughts about markets. But anyway, enough of an introduction. Kevin, thanks very much for taking the time. Glad to have you on the show with us today.
Oh, it's always my pleasure to be with you today, Victor.
Now, Patrick, I'm going to call you Patrick. I can see that. Yeah, you and your partner, Patrick Terezna, do the market huddle. That's one of the things you do. Take 2 seconds and tell us about the market huddle.
Well, the market huddle is our, it's actually, we've gone to every second week now. We used to be weekly, but it was taking too much time. I have the great privilege of interviewing a wide variety of different guests. They're usually traders that are a little more sophisticated, and the topics that we explore are a little more kind of inside baseball. And then afterwards, Patrick and I kind of have some fun and talk about markets and enjoy ourselves and have a lighthearted, kind of breezy conversation about all the things that have happened.
So that's at the market, call it markethuddle.com. Now, when we had the World Outlook Conference, we had the speakers' dinner after that, and I know you came and you sat beside Joseph Schachter, who's been a frequent guest on the show. But one of the reasons you sat beside Joseph is that he was pals and worked with your dad years ago when your dad was head of research at Richardson Greenshield Securities.
That's right. I didn't actually realize because not only was Joseph working with my father, but he's also a fellow Winnipegger. Mm-hmm. And I always assumed because he started at Richardson Greenshields when he was in Toronto, and I always kind of thought he was from here, but it turns out that he lived in the same neighborhood and he actually knew the same people in terms of my father was the research director and the head of Richardson was a fellow by the name of Chuck Winograd, and him and Joseph were good friends way back when. And so we had a lot of fun reminiscing about the old days.
Now, I mentioned your dad because I know you've told me before that when you were a kid, you know, your dad at the dinner table would be talking about the stock market. So you got interested in the markets at a very early age. And then after you, I guess before you were done with university, you were working with one of the major Canadian banks on their institutional desk.
Yes, I actually have a kind of a funny story about how I got into the industry. I went and I actually started at Bank of Montreal InvestorLine, which is a discount stock brokerage division. And I got there and it was at the start of kind of that whole process of people being able to phone up and trade for themselves. And they were super busy. And next thing I knew, I was the manager of this desk. And I said, well, I don't want to do this. This isn't what I wanted to do. I always wanted to be a trader, not an order taker. So I took up and I went to Chicago and I didn't like Chicago very much in the pits. And I came back and I still hadn't got my degree. And I was lucky enough to get a job on the RBC Institutional Equity Derivative Desk. And what I was the fellow that actually handled all the index orders and the basket trades. And my boss likes to joke about it. He says, Kev, there was guys that were better at computers and there was guys that were better at trading, but you were just the right mix of both.
That's a compliment. Now listen, your website is macrotourist.com. There's a bit of a self-mocking ring to macro tourist. I mean, why don't you tell us what a macro tourist is?
My tagline is all I bring to the party is 25 years of mistakes. I'm actually going to have to change that. I think it's probably been 30 or 35 by now. Macro tourist is actually a kind of a derogatory term that people usually use for traders that have kind of wander into a square, and it's generally a macro kind of trade. They don't really know what they're doing and they're just tourists and they put these trades on and they usually do badly. So I always thought that this was kind of a funny name, and people used to say to me, you know, Kevin, it's not a good thing to be a macro tourist. And I said, I got that. It's kind of tongue firmly in cheek.
Well, actually, I like the title because for me, it indicates that if you're willing to call yourself the macro tourist, you've got some humility. And for traders in the markets, if you're not humble, sooner or later,
the market will do it for you.
Exactly. Okay, listen, let's talk about some of the things you wrote lately. And as I say, you publish like an editorial piece. That editorial is the wrong term, but instead of just notes, you put something out with your opinions attached. And you wrote two articles recently about the correlation between stocks and bonds. Now, this could be a really dry subject, but you said it's probably the most important decision that a lot of people are going to have to make is what they're going to do in their portfolio with the relationship between stocks and bonds. So take it away.
So I actually think that this is the biggest challenge that are facing investors for the next couple of decades. And let's just step back and think about what the correlation between stocks and bonds means. Generally, in most of the period that investors have, modern investors have experienced, we've had what they call a negative correlation between stocks and bonds. And this means that when stocks have a bad, period, whether it be because of a crash or because of the economy does badly, bonds would rise. And by having that negative correlation, it means that if you are owning a portfolio that is comprised of both stocks and bonds, they will become the kind of mixing those two assets into your portfolio will have a dampening effect. you know, when we had the 2000, the great financial crisis, and the stock market went down 30-40%, the bond portion saved you. Same with the 2000 crash. And even in 1987, eventually what happened was the market crashed, but your bond portion did really well. And that relationship has held for last 40, 50 years, basically ever since Paul Volcker broke the back of inflation. And it ends up being kind of a complicated reasoning of why that relationship might change. But if it has changed, and we do see a situation where stocks and bonds can move together, then a portfolio that is traditionally, let's say, 60% equities and 40% bonds, instead of that bond portion being something that, you know, I would call a ballast to your portfolio, it actually might become the anchor that drags your portfolio down. And this is what we saw in 2021 and 2022. Instead of bonds kind of providing positive returns, they had two of the worst years ever. So not only were you losing on your stock portion in 2022, but you were also losing on your bond portion. And when you look at the 60-40 portfolio, it had one of the worst years in, I think it might have been almost 100 years. And if that relationship between the correlation between stocks and bonds has flipped for good, it means that people are going to have to think about their portfolios in a dramatically different fashion.
Well, we had interest rates hit, call it 5,000-year lows, right, in August of 2020. I think the 10-year Treasury yield was down to about 0.5%. We're closer to 4% yields now. One of the things, Kevin, that I've said on this show a lot is that with zero interest rates that we had for more than a decade, a lot of people who would traditionally have been savers had to do something else. They had to get involved in the markets and that sort of thing. And now that interest rates have gone back to like 5%, maybe on a GIC, people that want to be savers or should be savers have got, you know, some motivation to put their money there and to get out of other markets as well. We've seen, for instance, the recent auctions in the United States with yields higher than they were previously. We've seen some pretty aggressive bids on the institutional side. And also I see foreigners are coming in and buying the bonds at these higher yields. But if you consider that for some folks, you know, there's money moving into that market, but for a lot of folks that are listening to our show, I'm going to say, or I think the balance of our audience is maybe north of 50 years of age, and people, when they get older, they kind of get told you should have a bigger weighting in your portfolio of bonds than of stocks. So with that kind of an input, where do you go from here if you are one of those kind of people that has had this thought that, you know, the bonds will balance out any weakness I have in the stock market?
Right. As you get older, you definitely have to de-risk your portfolio, and you have to make it so that it's not as subject to the swings of the market, and you're going to need the money, so it needs to be invested in safer things. The real problem you're going to face is that, yes, interest rates have gone up now, and you're absolutely correct, Victor, to highlight that when they were 1, 1.5, or 0, there was only one way they were going to head. They were going to head higher eventually, and it was just a question of when. Now we have a situation where you can get 4 or 5%, but the problem is that you get 4 or 5%, and first of all, that's only at the what they call the short end, meaning that only if you invest for 30 days or a year or something. If you actually try to invest for 10 years and buy, let's just say, a US 10-year treasury bond note, it's more like 3.5%. And the real problem ends up being that what's the inflation rate going to be over the next 10 years? And if the inflation is no longer this kind of sub 2%, and we just saw a situation where we had inflation at 8-9%, then yes, you could be earning a nominal 3.5% for the next 10 years, but it doesn't really help you if you have an inflation rate of, let's say, 5%, which is what I think will happen. We will average somewhere between 4-5% over the ensuing decade. And so your what they call real return, meaning the return after inflation, will actually be negative.
Yeah, I'm certainly sympathetic to that. And I mean, the last couple of weeks here, the bond yields have been rising pretty steadily in the market. I guess if we go back the past couple of months, bond yields fell quickly in the aftermath of the banking crisis, if I can right. call it that in quotation marks, in the United States. But over the last 6 weeks or so, people have been recalculating or maybe taking to heart what Paul Volcker keeps saying is we don't plan to cut interest rates this year, folks. Getting inflation down is really important to us. So even though the market seems to be pricing the forward strips on the short rates, pricing the Fed to fall or lower interest rates, he's saying, no, we're not going to do that.
Right. And we're kind of at this dilemma because the actual economy is surprisingly strong. If you look at Wall Street and Bay Street, they keep anticipating a rolling over of the actual economy, and it's not coming. And what's happening is that as rates go higher, the market keeps saying, okay, well, now that this is going to cause a stress that we're going to see a crash of some sort. And then when the crash comes, they will have to lower rates dramatically. And so we have this push and pull between an economy that ends up being stronger than folks expect, yet as they raise rates to slow it down, they become more convinced that we are going to have a crash in the markets or in the economy, and therefore rates will be lower. Yet it just doesn't, it's not here. It doesn't happen. And we have this, they call it the hard data versus soft data. Soft data are things like surveys and kind of asking people how they think about the economy, asking CEOs, asking, you know, people you phone up and you say, what are your plans to spend? And all those, that data is showing that the economy is about to roll over. Yet when we look at the hard data, meaning the actual unemployment and what people are spending, that continues to be hard and strong. So we have this dichotomy where we have soft data showing that the economy is about to roll over, but the hard data refuses to kind of confirm that. And this is the greatest divergence that we've had between the soft and hard data ever. And it's left a lot of investors kind of shaking their heads, wondering what to do. And you talk about the fact that the bonds were bid, meaning people were buying a lot of bonds because they were convinced that we were going to have a banking crisis and the economy was about to roll over and the Fed would be, you know, cutting interest rates. Well, if you actually look at what's priced in for the Fed cutting interest rates or the Fed's forward path for the next quarter, it used to be kind of a month or two ago when the bank crisis was running high, they were starting to price in the chances of a cut. Well, guess what? We're now pricing in almost 100% chance that they're going to raise by 25 basis points over the next two meetings.
Yeah. So there's the short-term view on things, and then there's the longer-term view. I know you and I have talked about the bond market before from a longer-term perspective, and it just seems to me that the government and the people who vote for the people who form the government are just kind of sanguine about the prospect of deficits. Right. That, you know, we don't need to balance the books, you know, and for we could go into modern MMT, modern monetary theory. And it seemed to me that that was kind of predicated on the notion that MMT would be fine so long as you didn't get inflation starting to run away.
Right.
And it would seem to me that if we're going to continue to run government deficits, and that will mean we will have higher than normal inflation, or I should say the inflation that we've had over the last 20 years. And if that's the case, you certainly don't want to own bonds.
Well, you're absolutely right. And the MMT and that kind of distinction about the change in attitude about spending is ultimately why I believe that we are in a secular rising inflationary environment. Just rewind back to the great financial crisis when Obama was there and we had all this collapse in the economy and everyone was convinced that the problems were too much debt. There was this famous book by those two economists called Reinhardt and Rogoff, and it was the perils of spending too much and how this creates a financial crisis, and everyone cut. And even though the private sector was cutting, the government also cut. And the Obama with the Tea Party and the sequestration, they were actually forced to cut, and that's why the ensuing recovery was so weak. Fast forward to 2020, and we have the COVID crisis. Yet this time they come and they realize that if they just cut rates, that's not good enough. They need to actually spend. And you referenced MMT, that, you know, with the help of understanding MMT, they said we need to do fiscal on top of just monetary stimulus to get us out of this hole. The problem is that they did way too much fiscal. And it's actually one of the problems of MMT is that people aren't being honest about this, that they've done too much. Yes, fiscal is very powerful, but it was almost too powerful. And it was always, the MMTers will always say that we have no financial constraint. We have what's called a real resource constraint, which is basically you can spend until you create inflation. And at that point, you need to cut back on your spending. Well, the trouble was that we spent all the way up there and we just kept going. And it's not only that, it doesn't look like it's changed. If you go look at there's no more Tea Party, even though they're arguing a little bit about cutting back on the spending, on the whole, governments throughout the world are spending more and more. And that is why we are getting more and more inflation.
And the people who vote for those government, pardon me, that's what they want. They want the spending.
Right.
I think a book for the period that you were talking about was Gary Schilling's book, The Age of Deleveraging. And Gary Schilling was a huge bond bull, stayed bullish on bonds for 20 years. He had a hell of a run. From the Volcker period of time when interest rates were 15 to 20% down to August of 2020 when they were essentially 0.5%, it was like the greatest bull market ever, I guess, in the bond market. And it's over. And you're saying it's over, like you put a fork in it, it's done.
Right. And listen, that doesn't mean we're not going to have periods where inflation goes back down. Like we're in one of them right now, even though inflation is showing 5% on a year-over-year basis. That's because you're looking at the past 12 months and including the rises that were 6 months ago. If you look at the last 6 months, our inflation, or at least the U.S. inflation, is running closer to 3%. Inflation's already come back down. But when I look at kind of the tendency for voters to decide if they want to balance budgets and cut back on spending, it just doesn't seem to be there. One of the big things you could say is that you look at millennials. Millennials up until now have been kind of politically apathetic. They haven't gone out and voted, but they're coming out. They're actually, everyone talks about the boomers and how important they are. And they are important in that they own the most assets. But when you look at the actual numbers of the different generations, the millennials are by far the biggest. And as they become more involved and as they start holding the reins of power, I think you're going to find that they continue to spend more. And, it's just, instead of getting all upset about it and arguing about whether it's right or not, I always just say to people, trade the market that you have, not the market you want. And that's what I suggest to people. Don't worry about whether it's right or wrong. Just say, this is the reality of our economic situation. I have to adjust my portfolio accordingly.
Well, I've had this impression, and I think I've read it in your letter so many times. Don't trade the market the way you think it should be. Trade it the way you think it will be.
Right.
And I think you've just said that. Yeah, we can all hope that such and such will happen, but the reality does seem that governments, we look at the call it negotiations, to be polite, over the debt ceiling limit here. There's a group of Republicans who I think rightly so are saying, hey, we've got to rein in this spending, and yet they're kind of painted as wild and crazy guys that, are willing to bankrupt the United States. I shouldn't say bankrupt, but cause the United States to default to, sticking to their guns. But, there is some sense to what they say. We have to at some point limit government spending, but the way I describe it, Kevin, it doesn't seem as though there is a political consensus in any way to stop that kind of spending.
Right. And I actually, one of the geopolitical analysts that I like, and I don't usually like geopolitical analysts because usually I find they just get you into trouble dreaming up all these terrible things and talking about things that have a low chance of occurring. But this fellow is named Marco Papich, and he's from Clock Tower Research, and he used to be at this great firm called BCA Research in Montreal.
Right.
And he talks about the median voter and what the median voter, how their attitudes have changed. And he'll say that if you look at the median voter and take what they were interested in 2009, it was balancing the budgets. It was cutting back on spending. And you compare that to now, and the median voter has no interest in that. They're more interested in, you know, ensuring that their society is more in the way that they want it to be, and they're prepared to spend to do that.
Yeah. Kevin, you are a trader as well as an analyst, and I think when I read your daily stuff, I think maybe you see yourself as a trader or investor first and an analyst second.
I would agree.
Okay. So let's talk. You wrote another piece recently that I thought was just terrific, and flat is a position too. And what you and I mean by flat is I don't have a trade on. You know, I'm just sitting here with cash and I'm scratching my head and I'm not sure I want to do anything. Tell us why flat is a position.
Well, the kind of most popular trade to talk about in terms of when you go around the world, it's the S&P 500. It is the biggest and most liquid market in the world. It represents what the economy of the largest and most prosperous country in the world has done. And it's also where people offset risk, like whether, you know, you be an Asian manager and you're looking to buy insurance for, let's just say, the market crash. You don't go and buy it on your index. You go buy it on the S&P 500. And too often we all feel, or at least me, you know, professional investors feel like they have to have a position in it. They have to have a view on the S&P 500. They have to say, I think it's going up or I think it's going down. And the point of the piece was to say that sometimes it's not that easy. And sometimes that you should just be, I don't really know where it's going. And not only that, there's better trades out there. One of my all-time kind of heroes of hedge fund managers that I love to watch and I hang on his every word is a fellow by the name of Stanley Druckenmiller. And Stanley Druckenmiller, along with George Soros, was the fellow that broke the Bank of England with the pound. And he's just an absolute fantastic risk taker. And he did a speech recently and he said, I have the lowest amount of positions that I've had in quite some time. And his whole argument is that I can leave the bat, my baseball bat on my shoulder, and I don't need to swing at every pitch. And I'm waiting for a fatter pitch before I get excited about it. And I'm very sympathetic to that view. And the reason is because the S&P 500 is increasingly just a market of kind of five or six stocks. And those five or six stocks are those big tech stocks. So, you know, they were originally called the FANG mats. They were Facebook, Apple, Netflix, although Netflix is gone, Microsoft, Alphabet, and Tesla. And they've kind of moved around. And recently we've added NVIDIA. But we have this extremely narrow market where the increases that we've seen over the last, 6 months have all been because of the rises in these stocks. And these stocks are just getting more and more expensive and people are crowding into them. And I don't feel comfortable buying them. I don't want to buy them. I'm the first one to say that that there's a potential that there's a bubble being created. But the thing about bubbles is you got to be careful about shorting a bubble because it can go far, much farther than anyone thinks. So I just kind of looked at this and said, well, I don't want to buy those big stocks that represent 29% of the S&P 500 or something. And yet I'm looking around the world and I'm saying there's other kind of countries and other indexes that are doing quite well. And I just take Japan, for example. Japan just hit an all-time high, or not an all-time high, but a high for this move. The stocks are cheap. They're trading well. Most people are underweight them. And I think, why am I sitting around trying to, you know, decide on what these five or six stocks are going to do when I can go buy something that is cheap that I feel much more comfortable with and that is actually behaving well? So I have kind of a wide variety of different non-US equities that I hold. And ultimately, one of the reasons that I think that people should be kind of broadening their investment horizon or investment like the landscape that they think about things, is that everyone is too overweight the U.S. market. And the reason that they're overweight the U.S. market is that for the last 10, almost 20 years, the U.S. has been the place to be. It has crushed everyone else. There's been no doubt about it. Like if you're a European pension fund manager and you weren't overweight U.S. equities, you no longer have a job. Same with like, you know, a Japanese or a Swiss, you had to own U.S. equities. But the problem is that we've had this, all these people rushing into the U.S. Market. And so what I think it is, it's an over-owned, overbought, and too expensive market that it has a lot of risk in it. And I suspect that in the coming years, and maybe even over the next decade, that we will see a move out of the U.S. And it won't even be that they think that the rest of the world is so good. It's just that all that will be happening is that people will be reducing their portfolios back down to what's called benchmark. They were overweight the U.S., and just the move back to benchmark is going to be enough to have the U.S. underperform in the coming years.
Yeah, I think I saw on a market capitalization basis, the United States market was 70% of the world market. And I've saw the same trend that you did, that America, that like capital. Let me go this way. I talk about the U.S. dollar a lot. I trade currencies probably more than I trade stocks. And I describe the U.S. dollar as, money comes to America for safety and opportunity. I remember in the dot-com period, call it 98, 99, the U.S. dollar was just soaring as capital was coming to America because of the opportunities in the dot-com space that weren't available in other places in the world. And, you know, you get these ebbs and flows from one market to another. Here's another sidebar. When you mentioned the Japanese market in your letter 2 weeks ago, I went and looked at it. I mean, I always have the Nikkei on my screen, but I hadn't been paying close attention. But you also mentioned the Mexican market. Now, from a currency trading perspective, I've been looking at the Mexican peso. Now, from 1995 until the COVID crisis in the spring of 2020, I think the peso lost about 75% of its value. But since then, the Mexican peso has been one of the strongest currencies in the world. And I kind of, my first take on that was, well, right these days, the short-term interest rate in Mexico is about 11.5% on like 3 months Mexican paper compared to 5% in the United States. And I thought that was one of the reasons that the Mexican currency was doing so well. But when you alerted me to the Mexican stock market and I went and looked at it, and it's at a 9-year high and it's been really ripping, I thought, oh, I bet you that's having some impact on the Mexican peso as well.
Oh, for sure. And the idea of why I was so excited about Mexico was that COVID, the crisis, put in motion what a lot of people are talking about is deglobalization. For, you know, the previous 30, 40 years, we saw more and more trade, an increasing amount of trade. We saw jobs moving over to China and stuff like that. But then all of a sudden, when COVID happened, we realized that there was negatives associated with this. All of a sudden, if you don't create your own, you know, medical supplies, that this could be scary. And then all combined with the Ukraine war, when all of a sudden it seemed to be that geopolitically we weren't as stable, and countries like the Europe that had relied on Russia to supply gas, all of a sudden that became even more kind of precarious and worrisome. So we have this kind of deglobalization happening, or people bringing, or countries bringing back manufacturing to their own shores for safety reasons. And when you look at that, there's also something called friendshoring. And friendshoring is groups of countries getting together and saying, we'll do this together. And the best kind of example of friendshoring is North America, the North America Free Trade Act. And you think back to the America, Canada, and Mexico. And for a while there in the 90s, it looked like Mexico was going to become the workshop of America, and all those things were going to get created there and done that. But then what happened was, China came along. China came along, they lowered their currency, they devalued to make their currency more competitive. And then not only that, they were admitted into the World Trade Organization, and they ate Mexico's lunch, in essence. Well, I think when you look at this deglobalization and this trend towards friendshoring, it means that Mexico is prime, like it's just set up to take advantage of becoming America's workplace again. And I suspect that when you look back, this was a great opportunity to buy Mexican stocks and their currency. You mentioned the fact that they have an 11% interest rate. Their inflation is way less than 11%, I believe. So I think that you're earning a positive return on that. And you can just own that outright. And it's a terrific trade in many different ways. And I think it's going to work for a variety of different reasons.
Kevin, you and I have both been traders for decades. When I go back, I always have a little bit of a nervousness about emerging markets. And nobody said it better than Donald Cox. And I think you know where I'm going with this. Donald Cox said, emerging markets are markets you cannot emerge from in an emergency. So I've always been a little bit nervous. I think I just want to play in domestic markets. By that, I mean Canada and the United States. And if I can't find an opportunity here, I'll just go fishing or golfing or whatever it is. How do you deal with that? Like something could be happening in Japan or Mexico that you just have no idea. You just don't see it coming. Is it just, you size your allocation to emerging markets, or how do you manage that?
Well, you do have to change your volatility, your positions based upon your volatility. And I also think that the world has changed. It used to be a lot harder to buy and sell Mexican stocks. And now you can get on your Interactive Brokers accounts and buy and sell it like in a heartbeat. Same with Japan. I was shocked. I didn't realize I traded my first Japanese stock. I'd never traded Japanese stocks. And when Warren Buffett in 2020 started buying these five, what they call trading houses, I said, well, I'm going to do this too. And Warren Buffett knows a lot more than me. And so I figured out the different numbers of the current of the stocks, because they don't have symbols there. They don't use letters. They use numbers. And I just got on there and I traded it. So I'm not quite as concerned as it used to be. And I think that that's just a function of the increased globalization of the financial markets. And you're in and out in a heartbeat. The only thing I would say is that, like, let's just go back to Russia, the time in the Russian situation when they went and invaded Ukraine. A lot of people started buying like the RSX, which was an ETF that was based upon the Russian stock market. And they were saying, let's cheap and blah, blah, blah. And they were telling us all about how, there's no problem with this. And I said, that to me isn't worth the risk. Like, there's a chance that we wake up tomorrow and that the government tells you you're not allowed to own that, which is exactly what happened. And I know people that are owning, they still own the RSX. They don't know how to get it off their sheets. It's going to be there for the rest of their lives. And it is a funny little aside. I have a little tag end of a short, meaning I was short the thing, and I can't get it off the sheets either. It sits there and it stares at me every day. So I view the underlying countries as more worrisome than just kind of putting all emerging markets together. And for like, I don't think that the risk of owning Chinese assets is worth it. And I'm kind of in your camp there. I'm saying, you know what? I understand the bull argument. I get it all. I'm just like, there's better things to own. I can buy Japan. I can go buy Mexico where I view there's less political risk. So I don't think you can put everything in one bucket like that. But I am sympathetic to that. There are some buckets that are more scarier than others, and those scary buckets, you definitely need to have the correct size position.
So I'm intrigued that you actually bought an individual Japanese stock rather than, say, a Japanese ETF or something. Do you do any sort of a currency hedge with that, or how do you handle that?
Well, no, I wanted the currency exposure, so I didn't do any hedge. I actually converted it. But you could do that if you felt that you wanted to be worried about the yen declining. But I'm actually a big Japanese yen bull as well, so I'll take that exposure. The other thing that I really like is the Japanese banks are super cheap, really, really cheap. And there's an ETF there that's I think the number is 1615, and what that is an ETF of all the Japanese banks. And I can't I'm not very good at picking stocks in terms of doing the analysis to go through and decide this one's no good, this one's not that. So I wanted to trade an index. And for me, I couldn't find an index of Japanese banks that were listed in North America. So I went and found this one in Japan. And again, it was super easy. Just get on my Interactive Brokers and, you know, buy it like any other stock.
Now, Kevin, it occurs to me that we got to talk time frame here. I mentioned Joseph Schachter a few minutes ago when we were starting the show, how your dad and Jim used to work together. Now, Joseph has come on the radio show here with us for many times over the years and talked about what he likes and what he doesn't like in the energy space. And for instance, I'm pretty short term with the trading that I do. My kind of ideal trading time horizons a few days to a few weeks. I think, you know, when I talk to Martin Murenbeel, our gold analyst, or Joseph Schachter, our energy analyst, they've got a much longer time frame than I have. When you're saying, for instance, that you want the exposure to the Japanese yen, I mean, I know the Japanese yen's been falling here the last couple of weeks, but that doesn't bother you because you've got a different time frame. Now, do you talk? Are all of your trades in the same time frame, or do you have different time frames for different things that you're doing?
No, so I do mix my time frames a lot, and it ends up being one of the difficulties and one of the challenges when you're writing something is to make sure you express and make it clear what time frame you're trading. And as a trader, it's also very difficult to keep it in kind of your time frames straight in your mind, because, you know, what's a trade that's gone? What's the definition of an investment? It's a trade that's gone wrong. And that's the real problem that you run into. So you have to make sure that you, when you're putting something on, that you have a definite time frame about it. And so I just mentioned those Japanese stocks that I own when Buffett bought them. I've held those for a couple of years, and I'll put those away. At the same time, I'll go and do a trade just like you that's one day, 2 days long, and I'll talk about that. And so I do mix my time frames a lot. I try to talk about longer term things that people can take advantage of as opposed to shorter term things. But there are, like, the occasional trade where I'll talk about, oh, there's an imbalance caused by this big option trade that's going to occur here, and this is something you can take advantage of for the next couple of days.
So if we go back to where we started, and just as a way to wrap up this interview, about the bond market, you were saying, you know, the bond market had a horrible year last year. The stock market had a horrible year. And for people who had a 60-40 portfolio of some kind, it was double horrible because of that. Right. With your longer term time frame on bonds, you basically, not to put words in your mouth, but you just said, I don't want to own them longer term. But you could see that something could happen. Certainly, if we get any kind of a crisis in the market here, the bond market could go bid very aggressively.
I'm not even sure about that second half of the statement. Like, okay. That's how bearish I am. There are times that I will be kind of like, I think Dennis Gartman used to say, when you're bullish, there's only two things to be, or three positions to have. And it was like, if you're bullish, it's long, really long, or flat. And if you're bearish, there's only three positions, you know, short, really short, or flat. And for me, I'm such a secular bond bear that when I get bullish on bonds, it's just basically I'm flat. And that's kind of how bearish I am. And one of the things that I really worry, because a lot of people made a lot of money throughout the last 40, 50 years by betting on the Fed lowering rates in times of crisis. And I'm not sure that that's going to be the go-to play. Then that's not where you're going to make your money. And I really think that people should think long and hard about what the inflation dynamic means. They should go study the 60s and the 70s and look at how things behave there. It behaved much differently. And I'll just say one thing. I just like kind of when you're thinking about bonds, this is how I like to explain it to people these days. In the 1970s, we had all sorts of inflation, and it went up, and it was like literally went down to 10 plus, and Volcker had to go and raise rates to kill inflation. And when he did that, the economy came to, you know, slowed down, and inflation went down to 2 or 3%. Yet what happened was the that bonds, because everyone was so scared about inflation returning, bonds continued to offer what's called a high real yield, meaning that, you know, inflation was 3%, yet the bond, the 10-year bond market was trading at like 10%, meaning you could earn 7%. And that real yield took many years for it to finally decline until it went negative. I suspect what we're going to have is that whole process in reverse. We're going to be so convinced that tomorrow inflation is going to be gone. We're going to be back to the period like 2010 to 2020 when inflation is 0 to 2%, that people are overpaying for bonds and they're buying it and they're expecting this. And what they're going to find is their real yield, meaning their yield after inflation, will be dramatically worse than they're expecting.
Well, that's a hell of a point. And listen, that's a good point to wrap it up on. I appreciate you coming on the show with us today. I know we'll be asking you to come back again, but I think you and I are on the same page for bonds, but you're even more bearish than me, and that's pretty bearish. Kevin, thanks, buddy. I'm glad you could be with us today, and keep writing those great letters that now, if people want to see you, if they go to macrotourist.com, they can't see any of the things that you write.
You know, if they send me an email, just send me an email, kevin@themacrotourist.com, and I'll be more than happy to fire off some examples for them.
Oh, okay. That's super. So kevin@
themacrotourist.com.
Themacrotourist.com. Thanks for that, and good luck out there, my friend.
Thanks. Always great to chat with you, Victor.
Well, as I said at the top of the show, we can't have a Money Talks program without Mike Campbell. But, of course, Mike's in Europe on a vacation, a well-deserved vacation, by the way. But we've dug into the archives, and I've got a quote I want to play for you. But just before I get Mike's quote of the year, as he called it, I want to tell you about the Special Olympics event in Mayfair Lakes, Vancouver, on the 15th of June. This is the BC Classic, and you can find out all about it. Just Google Special Olympics BC, and Google will take you, and you'll see a page where you can go to Special Olympics BC Classic. You can get all the information there that you want to know about this tournament, who the sponsors are, and there's a heck of a great list of sponsors. You can sign up to play golf. You can become a sponsor yourself. You can donate cash. I think you can even donate an auction item, but, you know, don't quote me on that. And you can find out just, you know, the terrific things that Special Olympics does for special needs kids throughout British Columbia. I mean, you remember here a couple of months ago, Mike and Ozzy and Gordon Campbell were jumping into English Bay in the freezing weather to raise money for Special Olympics. People all over British Columbia were taking the polar plunge to help out Special Olympics to create, you know, raise money for all the projects they do. Anyway, enough here. Go to Special Olympics BC on your Google, and you'll find all the information you need. Please consider either playing or helping out in some way. You know, it is a good cause, no doubt about it. Okay, so the quote of the week. This is Mike called it the quote of the year, and it was in the December 28th wrap-up show we did at the end of last year. And basically, this is Mike quoting something from the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal, and they were noting that people, and funny they would notice this, all over seem to be losing respect or the faith in or a lack of confidence in government, in institutions, and experts. Well, what a surprise. Here's what Mike had to say.
Time now for the quote of the year. Well, not a surprise that there were so many to choose from. Although, before I get to my choice, I have to ask myself a question, by the way. Did I choose this because it reinforces the longstanding, what I call primary trend that we talk about on Money Talks all the time? And that is the decline in confidence in government. Or is it an important measure that our thesis is actually getting more widespread acceptance? Probably a little of both. But I welcome the verification of the well-respected voices of the Wall Street Journal editorial board. But it's more important to note that until politicians, government officials, and in this particular case, Nobel Prize-winning economists who endorse President Biden's massive spending agenda as being non-inflationary, or I could go to public health officials like Dr. Anthony Fauci, who misled the public, understand the profound consequences of their actions, which undermines confidence in government. And yes, along with our political leaders, who the great columnist Peggy Noonan observes, we don't even have the expectation they tell us the truth. But it's not just politicians, as I said, it's the entire establishment, from public education, Canadian Medical Association, provincial counterparts to the mainstream media. What's noteworthy is that it's not that they don't see the distrust. No, they recognize it, which they dub populism, by the way, or the erosion of confidence in government and its institutions. Very few seem to understand or simply don't want to acknowledge the role they play in fueling that trend, which is why when the mainstream publications like the Wall Street Journal acknowledge the problem, that I think it's so significant. Here's the quote of the year. In quotes, "One hallmark of our era is the collapse of public trust in government and experts of all kind. But it's hard to fault the public when so many experts and their policies have failed in such spectacular fashion. The inflation that progressives helped to cause, failed to anticipate, and then ignored is one example of earned public distrust." End of quote. And I think there's many other examples. But as I say, I think that's one of the major overriding trends that we're going to be dealing with that has implications for all sorts of things from social to economic.
Well, we're back and I've got Ozzie Jurek with us. Ozzie, before we started this conversation here, you'd sent me some notes a day or two ago about pre-sales in the real estate space. And I saw you, it was a very, very full list of things that you should pay attention to. But let's start at the basics. I mean, what is a pre-sale and why do people buy them?
Well, essentially, you put down a little bit of money, maybe 5% in some developments and up to 20%. And this is, you're literally buying a piece of paper, right? Because it's pre-sale, means it's before it has been built, you're buying it, right? So, and why do people buy it? Well, look, I can tie up today's cost, today's price, and the building in a high rise may not be finished for 5 years. And so what I believe maybe in 5 years, the market conditions might be better than today, et cetera, et cetera. Or the mortgage rates are lower. So I tie myself up a piece of real estate at today's prices, essentially. That's why people do it.
So in my business, that would sound like I'm buying an option, like I've got a fixed price and I can take delivery of something at a point in the future, but I'm only putting up a fraction of the cost right now.
That's exactly it. The only difference is in your business, if you buy a piece of gold, you get a piece of gold. And if you buy a long-term future on almost any other commodity, that's what you get. In a pre-sale, you ought to be careful that you get what you thought you got when you signed a piece of paper.
Okay. And I think I remember a few years back when the real estate market was really churning that people would buy a pre-sale and then subsequently sell it to somebody else well before the property was even bought. So you almost had like a security that you were trading.
That's true. And the real estate industry took a lot of flack for that because some people didn't report the capital gain that they made. But of course, that's not the realtor's problem. That's the buyer that made $100,000 profit flipping it to somebody else and then not declaring it. That's actually illegal, right? So right now that is a lot less likely, although the market in pre-sales, as we discussed a couple of weeks ago, is fairly strong. But I think somebody, before you sign on the dotted line, you got to ask yourself some questions.
Sure. Well, let's get into those questions. I mean, if I was to go out and buy a pre-sale, just like if I was going to go out and buy an option on gold in the future, I want to know what I'm getting into. And the more you do it, I guess, the better you are. But for somebody that's a first-time person, and they probably think, you know, I think real estate market's going higher. I like the location of this thing. I think this is going to be popular. I'm going to buy this, and I will either move into it in the future or I'll be able to sell this for a profit. So what do I need to know before I sign on the dotted line?
Well, first of all, I'm just putting up a down payment, right? So I'm not buying the whole thing, only a small amount of money. But if the building is ask yourself, if I buy on the fourth floor and I look at the zoning and another building could be right in front of me, I may not have any view. So either buy higher or don't buy that unit at all. Understand what the zoning is around the building. What are the site influences? Is there a nightclub? Is it a busy street? Never buy over a garage. You know, you forget that the garage door goes up and down all night long. Well, rather, at night you hear it. During the day, you almost don't hear it. Don't buy over an entrance, because even five floors up, you hear, is George home? Well, everybody listens in, right? It's a garbage removal early in the morning. You know, the wee, wee, wee of the garbage truck. There's all of those kind of things. Take a look. Are there any vents on the outside of your windows plant? You know, because the thing is, if you're looking at a piece of paper, you want to make sure that all buildings have good suites and bad suites, good locations and bad. And people ask me for advice, I will tell them what to buy and what not to buy in some of those buildings. The other thing is the parking space. You know, in a high rise, always ask for either P1 or P2. Otherwise, they'll assign you a P7, right? You're on seven floors down. And also make sure that you're clear. Where is it in relation to the elevator or the ventilation system? And also, is it the right size? There have been lawsuits where the parking spot itself was really much smaller. You would have had maybe a very baby car in there than a regular kind of car. So ask those kind of questions. On the legal side, keep copies of everything, of the advertising, the videos, the marketing materials. Does the builder reserve the right to replace materials of like materials? If you wanted to have concrete building, or if you wanted to have a specific countertop, then write it into the contract, or otherwise I won't buy. I got to have that. The other thing we saw last year, a builder took a high rise that was concrete construction and said, this is too expensive, I'm going to change it into wood construction. Well, does your contract allow that? Have your lawyer take a look at it. I mean, keep thinking of things that go wrong. Sounds like it's a bad thing, but it just protects you down the road.
Sure, and I suppose, you know, a lot of things can happen between now and the assumed completion date of this property. I just can't imagine the quagmire you could get into if somewhere along the line the builder went bankrupt and you got a half-built structure, and now you're just... What happens in that case? You're just going to deal with lawyers for a long time.
Well, it has happened, and it's happening right now. We had a building in Richmond where, you know, several hundred people put their deposit in. Now, the deposit is put in trust with a law firm that is not the builder, right? So the problem is, when are you going to get it back? Because the builder goes for bankruptcy protection, it might take years to be resolved. In the meantime, you can't get access to the money, right? The other thing is, you have the opportunity cost that you lost, right? I thought I bought something 2 years ago, now it's going to be finished, and in fact, it won't be. That's why you want to check out the builder, ask a lot of questions. Has he been building it before? What is sort of his reputation? But the other thing is, if it's finished, but it's not what you thought it would be. You know, it says 300 square foot balcony, but really it's only 200. Well, take a picture of the plan where it says it's 300, or the whole floor plan and square footage. It's so quick and so easy to just take a copy of what was handed out and the promises made. Right now, they're selling a lot of buildings called short-term rentals, and that's what you want to do. You want to have a business in there. Well, when you got to talk to the city, because in Vancouver, yes, we allow short-term rentals, but only if it's your primary residence, and that wasn't your intention at all. So you got to give it some thought, if what you want to accomplish and whether that's legal or possible.
Okay, Ozzie, we're talking at this side on the person who is looking to buy a presale because he thinks he can make a profit, or he wants to buy the presale and move into the building later. On the other side, why do the builders offer pre-sale? I'm assuming it gives them capital that they wouldn't otherwise have, but what's the view from the builder's side?
Well, he actually probably will have 60% of the building pre-sold in order to get the financing to build the building, because very few builders go out and have an $80 million laying around, so they need financing. And the bank says, okay, how excited are people about your development? And where is it then? And how much of the land do you own? And so 60%, so if you have a 400-suite building, well, they want 240 sales pre-sold. And there's a law that he only has a certain amount of time to actually sell that or raise those 60% buyers, or he cannot proceed. Sometimes you wonder what happened to a development. All of a sudden, they don't no longer sell it. The interesting question I got the other day is, so is that all I do? I put down the deposit? And that's true. it might say 20% is the total amount I'm going to put down, maybe 5% now, another 10% after the builder's permit, but that's it. The person asking me came from China, because in China, you put a pre-sale, put your deposit down, and you have to arrange the mortgage right away, and you make the mortgage payments even though it's just a piece of dirt right now. Well, we don't have that. So you have a lot of protection here. Your deposit is protected. You might have an opportunity lost, but you don't have any mortgage payments, and you know you don't have any further obligations. So it is relatively safe.
Okay, so then going back to the buy side, most of the people who step up and participate by doing a pre-sale or buying a pre-sale, are they looking to basically speculate on the real estate market, or is this something that they're planning their future and they want to go and live in this building once it's done?
Oh, I would say it's 20 to 25%. Yes, depends on the market conditions. But most of the time, look, you want to downsize, but we're not really ready. You know, I might be 65, but at 70, I really want to be out of my big house. And now I go around and see what's available in today's dollar. And if I believe, like I believe, and I write in my newsletter continuously, and you're saying it many times, that inflation is likely the outcome again because of all the money we're printing. So it's a wise thing for me to take maybe 20% of an $800,000 building, say $160,000. Then I know the building is going to be finished in 4 or 5 years when I'm ready to move, and I don't have to act right away, right? And so there's some real reasons why a pre-sale really works well. Plus, it's good for the city. You can plan the whole layout of what is going to happen in a certain area. What we recommend in our real estate action group is buy transit-oriented developments, TOD. Keep that in mind, TOD. Because that is your greatest resale value, you know, where people have less cars. You know, we have now ideas. The city in Vancouver wants to put a meter in our car, and the miles that we drive in the city of Vancouver, we have a tax on it. And, you know, they always find ways to new taxes. Well, maybe transportation becomes more and more important in the future. So buy something close by.
Okay, Ozzy, there's obviously a lot to this. Your website is ozbuzz.ca, is that correct?
That's right.
And if people want to know more about pre-sales, or if they want to know more about the real estate market, go to ozbuzz.ca and get the information.
Thank you. Also, if they want to go to REAG, Real Estate Action Group, which would be REAG.ca, and sign in under information, we'll send them an outline of what we just talked about and invite them maybe to one of our meetings if they want to come to one of our meetings.
Okay. Super. Oz, thanks for being with us. And, you know, Mike Campbell will be back next week, so you'll be talking to him.
And just remember, Victor, that in wine there is health, and in cognac there's power, and in beer there's freedom, and in water there's just bacteria.
Oh, you never disappoint, Ozzy. Thanks, my friend. Cheers. Well, I really enjoyed that interview with Kevin, and he does make me think. When I say, you know, he's even more bearish than me, he's clearly pretty bearish on the bond market. But what that's all about is it's inflation, you know, and I guess my core view is we're not going to go down to 2% inflation in a hurry, unless something really nasty happens. But anyway, I enjoyed the conversation with Kevin. It's the Money Talk Show. We couldn't have a Money Talk Show without Michael Campbell being on, and we've then dug into the archive and come up with a great goofy. And this one, I think, is, Mike loves to sort of stick it to the ineptitude that shows up so often in government. And, of course, with him, he takes it another step. And I think in this goofy here, he really lays it out for you. Yeah, the government's an ineptitude. But it seems a lot of people just don't care. So here's what Mike has to say in his own words.
Time now for the goofy of the year. Come on, lots of contenders. The fact that Western nations continue to put so many obstacles that discourage more production of oil and natural gas, which, of course, pushes prices higher, added to the value of Russian energy, by the way, their exports that they needed to finance the invasion. I mean, the list goes on. Why they didn't think of increasing supply, which benefited Russia, is, well, we know what it is. It's a green agenda. And certainly the failure to plan for backup power when the wind doesn't blow, sun doesn't shine. Come on, that's way up there. It's one of the dumbest moves I can recall in my lifetime. I mean, they had to, and they did, then they decommissioned nuclear plants on top of that. So you look at Germany doing that. And it's forced to massively increase the use of coal. Well, that ain't goofy. I don't know what is. And I'm not going to even go into the outrageous overreach during the truckers' convoy that saw government freeze bank accounts of people who were not charged with anything, let alone convicted. Their crime was supporting a legal protest. It's, by the way, it's very noteworthy that this didn't happen in Canada. No, there was much more outrage and shock by that move outside of our borders. A worthy candidates, to be sure. But after 2 years of government missteps, I've decided that this year's goofy goes to government and its failure to do its job in so many areas. 2022, for example, a World Bank S&P Global report ranked the Port of Vancouver, come on, the major gateway for consumer goods manufactured in Asia, 368th out of 370 of ports around the world for efficiency. But that arguably isn't actually the low light in travel. Come on, 2022 saw Toronto's Pearson International Airport lead the world in flight delays during the summer. And then there's the problem with luggage, the lost luggage problems that again became noteworthy in late in the second quarter into the summer. And now we don't even want to talk about this travel period for whether we're talking flight delays, inadequate machinery to handle the record snowfalls in some areas or the record freezing. Anyways, but that may even pale in comparison to record passport delays. People were literally lining up for days at the passport office. Now, keep in mind, despite warnings of increased travel demand, we got those warnings as early as October 2020 by other government departments. We had the unions representing the passport staff warned, and that was over a year earlier, hey, get prepared for a big jump in applications once travel restrictions are lifted. Despite all that, no action was actually taken by Service Canada. When travel returned, and it returned to about 55% of the pre-pandemic levels, so we're not talking back to those levels, but it returned to that in spring this year, while delays for passport went to months, not weeks. But I think this, even passport delays paled in comparison to delays for getting treatment for the government-run healthcare system. Now, after years of consistently ranking near the bottom of other Western healthcare systems, it seems to have finally dawned on at least an increasing number of Canadians that we've got a problem with a system. It's a system. It's not a problem with the medical professionals. In fact, we're burning some of them out because of the system. Canada consistently ranks last versus 10 other Western countries when it comes to access to care. I mean, we could be talking about how long it takes to see a physician when you go to an emergency room or waiting for surgery. I mean, plus, think about this. There's an acute lack of family doctors. Why? Because they've aged out, as if we're surprised that we have a demographic challenge. We don't have availability of diagnostic equipment like MRIs. That's been worn for years. And sadly, tragically, in 2020-21, over 11,500 Canadians died waiting for treatment. And the goofiest part is arguably our refusal, and that includes all of us, to have an honest, let me underline, honest conversation, especially when it comes to the role of private care. We act as if, by the way, it doesn't even exist in the system, yet doctors' offices, x-ray clinics, optometrists, dentists, physiotherapists, they all operate privately. Like so many areas, it doesn't matter. We could be talking climate policy or, you know, the failure to acknowledge the role that fossil fuels must play in the transition to renewables, or the dearth of necessary raw materials, or failing to acknowledge the need for backup power because the sun doesn't shine every day, or ignoring blatant fraud in the pandemic relief programs. And that was despite warnings from Revenue Canada and some major banks right from the outset. That we now know, by the way, that $1.6 billion went to people who had quit their jobs. $6.6 million went to people who were in jail the whole time. $3.3 million went to people who didn't live in Canada. $1.2 million went to dead people. We've got questionable payouts and now could be estimated as high as $50 billion range. I mean, the ineptitude of government has been on full display. But you know what? Arguably the goofiest part is that for millions of Canadians, that's okay. That's just fine. You know what? During this year, one of the things that came to mind so often for me is we've got the government we deserve because we simply don't demand better.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that, Goofy, as much as I did. And speaking of Michael, he will be back next week. It's been fun for me to host the show here for the 3 weeks while he's been away on vacation. I know one thing I forgot to do. We never had any trading live from the trading desk. So I have to let you know, I have been continuing to write my weekly blog at victoradair.ca, and you can get my comments as to what trading I'm doing in the market, why I'm doing what I'm doing, and sort of my reporting on the main markets that I pay attention to. I've also told you that coming up in just a couple of weeks here, we're going to have this once a year fundraising event for the Special Olympics people here in Oceanside on Vancouver Island. If you'd like to play in the tournament or you'd like to just donate some money to a very worthy cause, just Google Oceanside Special Olympics and you'll find out how you can do that. It's been great being with you today. I will be back again next week wearing my hat as live from the trading desk, and Mike will be your host. So go out and have a great weekend. Thanks for listening.